This is The Intersection, a weekly podcast hosted by me, Mark Riley. Glad you are with us. I've changed the name of The Intersection from CSDC, Can't Stop the Dancing Chicken, to The Intersection at the behest of my loving wife, who is now my executive producer. She says it's more conducive to posting and that sort of thing. And knowing nothing about that, I defer to her expertise. Lots of things to talk about, including the shutdown, which we'll get to. But first, President Donald Trump appears to be ready to negotiate, appears to be ready to deal over the border wall and the government shutdown, now the longest in American history. Should people believe him? Should the Congress believe him? I say no. Absolutely not. I would not negotiate with this man until he took the border wall off the table. In other words, no border wall, we can talk. But I'm sure my friends in Congress are negotiating from a different posture and in a different position. I know they are. They will negotiate something. They'll negotiate some kind of money less than the $5.6, $5.7 billion that the president wants. But you see, there is headway, I guess, with Donald Trump now saying he's prepared to negotiate. He's prepared to deal. I think that if you look at his track record, not just in terms of his time as president, but if you go back, and I would suggest and urge people who don't know about Donald Trump prior to his running for president, read Wayne Barrett's book on Donald Trump, which was published well before he ran for president. And you will see what kind of person you're dealing with. And what you find out very quickly is that this is a man who is not accustomed to sticking to his word about much of anything. So why do you think, or why should the Congress think, more importantly, that this is a man who can be trusted to keep his word? I don't understand it myself. I have a feeling he'll negotiate something, or he'll say he's prepared to negotiate something, and suddenly he moves the goalposts. That's been his history. That's who he is. Now, just as important as negotiations over the shutdown is the piece in BuzzFeed that alleges that Trump directed Michael Cohen, that was his lawyer, to lie to Congress. Despite the fact that Ben Smith, who's the editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed and who I know, saying they stand by their reporting, the piece has been undermined on several levels. One, some media have printed stories about one of the reporters that was involved in putting this piece together and saying that he had a checkered past and that there were some allegations that stuff he had published in the past turned out not to be true. And that sometimes happens with reporters. He says this one is the real deal. Now, the piece is further undermined by Robert Mueller, the special counsel, saying that parts of it were not accurate, which is cool. I mean, you know, Mueller's going to say what Mueller's going to say. The problem, of course, is that Mueller is not saying which parts of the piece are not true. He's not saying, no, it's not true that Michael Cohen was directed to lie to Congress by Donald Trump. That he's not saying. He's just saying the BuzzFeed piece is not accurate, or some parts of it are not accurate. Now, this is against the backdrop of a much larger picture as far as media is concerned. We have become so divided in this country that people on both sides, right, left, however you want to describe them, subscribe to media that reinforces their view of the world. Now, this is not new. It's been going on for a long time. People traditionally will subsidize and consume, more importantly, media that coincides with their worldview. But sometimes you have to ask yourself, is that the best way to consume media? And I'm saying it's not. It's not. I believe, and part of this is due to my background in media, I look at all sides of something. I may not agree with anything that the right conservatives or however you want to describe them. I may not believe in any of it, but I do try to understand how they came to that position. And I submit to you that not enough people are doing that in 2019. The other problem, and this is a problem that reporters, if you talk to them, will tell you, is that their editors and the people that run their media outlets, particularly newspapers, are hungry for what they call clickbait. Clickbait means stories that readers will look at on the frontispiece of a website, a newspaper website, and then click on to find out more information. So stories are written, stories are shortened and hyphenated because everyone is looking for clickbait. And reporters who do not provide material that is clickbait worthy don't stay at these different outlets for all that long. Just the other day, Dallas Morning News, respected paper in the state of Texas, laid off 43 people. Many newsrooms across America, as far as newspapers are concerned, look like graveyards, look like the graveyard shift used to look 20 years ago with three or four people. And that puts enormous pressure on reporters to get certain things done and to get people to look at what they're writing. We have to change this, folks. We have to stop feeding media that attracts attention. I'm not saying don't consume media that you agree with. That would be absurd. I'd be nuts to say that to you. But what I am saying is it's time for us to look at media and then take the next step. Think critically. If you look at Donald Trump, if you look at this president, the one thing that comes out, no matter what media you consume, is that he is, and I'll be charitable here, mercurial. Sometimes he says this, sometimes he says that. Sometimes he out and out lies. Sometimes he'll tell you, well, I'm not lying, I'm just repeating what I've been told. You see, that is a dangerous thing if you're consuming media that spotlights, as many do every day, and we went into that in a previous episode, everything that the man does. Wakes up in the morning, tweets, next thing you know, headline. Trump tweeted. It's become depressingly normal, the new normal. And I understand that people are not going to stop covering the president of the United States, but they cover him sometimes like he's still the head of a reality TV show. And that is dangerous. It is dangerous to the body politic. It is dangerous at the end of the day to democracy. It certainly is. And the question then becomes, and I don't have the answer. Maybe some of you do, and you can hit me back and tell me I'm crazy. But at what point does the media become more selective in what they cover about and from the mouth of Donald Trump? He is the president, after all, and it would be absurd to make it sound like, well, we're just not going to cover anything. Can't do that. You have to cover the man. He is the chief executive officer of the most powerful nation on earth. So you have to do something. But then the question becomes, how much and for how long? Is every tweet he comes up with worth your time, worth your readers or your viewers or your listeners' time? For some people, the answer is absolutely, because that's what the readers, viewers, whatever, that's what they want. They want to hear about Donald Trump. And it's not just Trump supporters that feel that way. There are people who abhor Donald Trump but still want to hear what he has to say so they can reinforce their reason for abhorring the man. I understand that. It's human nature. You certainly, and most people certainly, will follow what they believe. So if you believe Donald Trump is a rotten human being, or as one of my friends says, the orange imbecile, okay, if that's what you believe, then media that reinforces that belief is what you're going to consume first. And you may not bother looking at other media. I tend to consume media a little bit differently than most people because, again, I worked in it for a long time. So I know how it functions. I know how it operates. And there are times when I have to sit back and laugh at what some reporters have been required to do in order to maintain their jobs. Make no mistake about this. This is about people's livelihood, just like the shutdown is about people's lives. Can you imagine 800,000 to a million people in this great country, and they cannot make ends meet because the government they work for will not pay them over an issue regarding a border wall? Now, there are some conservative mouthpieces on television. Well, you know, it's such little money in the context of the national budget. I don't know why the Democrats are sitting back arguing over this $5.7 billion. It's not just the $5.7 billion. It is what a border wall represents in terms of the aspirations, the hopes, the dreams of Americans. Not people who want to come here, the people who are already here. You see, because if we start examining closely how many different groups of people got to America, you might have a very different attitude and a very different view of the whole issue of people coming from the southern border. The southern border is not full of criminals and gangsters and the rest, itching to come to the United States and kill Americans, which is kind of sort of the way Donald Trump tries to project it. It's not like that. Most of these folks just want to make a living, just want to attempt to participate in the American dream. And now they're seeing, as they want to do that, they are seeing this huge argument erupting to the point that almost a million Americans who are working for the government, which therefore means they are legally here, assuming the government vets properly, they're legally here. And they aren't getting paid. And there's no excuse for it. There is no excuse whatsoever for a government worker having to go on unemployment or having to pawn or sell household items in order to get the money to feed their families. That is inexcusable. And while we're talking about that, I want to shout out those freshman Congress people who went chasing after Mitch McConnell the other day. Because he's the guy who is responsible. Behind Donald Trump, it's him. He will not bring anything to the Senate that he's not sure Trump will sign. And what that means is, as the Democrats in the House have been trying to open the government piecemeal, he has stood in their way. And it was absolutely the right thing to do. And I'm glad to see these freshmen, these new Congress people, much more diverse than the old Congress people, taking Mitch McConnell to task and saying, "What's wrong with you, man? How are you doing this to the American people?" Now, what Donald Trump is trying to do is to change the terms of the negotiation. He will now come to the American people and say, "Well, I'll give you a deal on this or that or DACA or Dreamers or whatever in exchange for what I want, which is $5.7 billion for a border wall." I say the Democrats, his negotiating partners, should say abso-freaking-lutely not. No, we will negotiate. And they had a bill that would have given, I think, $1.3 billion in border security funding. But now, in this case, I might say, don't give them a dime. Don't give them a dime. Don't give him a dime. He's not worth it. And the things that he says he will do, I have absolutely no faith, no belief whatsoever that he will, in fact, do them. And that's important. This is The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley. Thank you for tuning into the podcast. For updates, like my Facebook page at Mark Riley Media. Send me an email at mark@markrileymedia.com. If you have a topic you'd like to cover, email me at mark@markrileymedia.com. After a brief pause, we will talk about an issue that someone got in touch with me and asked me to cover. So I try to be responsive. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Intersection of Politics and Culture with Mark Riley.
Welcome back. My name is Mark Riley. We're glad you are with us. One of our listeners, Judy Livingston, asked me to talk a bit about the 2020 presidential race, certainly on the Democratic side, assuming that Donald Trump remains the Republican nominee, which he probably will be, actually, most certainly will be. So the question then becomes, and thanks for the communication, Judy, who is running for the Democratic Party nomination for president? Depends on who you ask, who you talk to. You've got Elizabeth Warren on the one hand. You've got Kirsten Gillibrand. Both of them have already announced and, I believe, have set up exploratory committees. A host of other Americans that you probably have never heard of have also said they're tossing their hat into the ring. We won't go through them now. As we move forward, perhaps we will. Off to one side are a number of prominent Democrats who have yet to formally announce, from Cory Booker to Kamala Harris to Mike Bloomberg to Joe Biden to Bernie Sanders to many, many more. So the question becomes, like, who's going to prevail in all this? Who's going to be the nominee? And I guess from our times, they are a changing department from 4 years ago. 4 years ago, it was pretty much assumed that Hillary Clinton was going to be the Democratic nominee, which she was. This time around, the field is much, much more open. Now, here's a clue in terms of your consumption of media when it comes to this. Media has a tendency to view elections as horse races. They might as well be at the Belmont or at the Kentucky Derby or something. Who's this? Who's that? What polls are saying this? Who's likable? Who's not likable? This is how the media covers elections. And of course, now that we're into 2019, it's the perfect time to start speculating. I can say intensely disliked the notion of treating political elections like horse races. Now, there are going to be a lot of folks who are going to eventually throw their hat in the ring. It's wide open. And I, for one, am happy to see that take place. I don't have a problem with large numbers of people seeking a party's nomination to president. Remember, the Republicans had 16. And who emerged? The guy that's running the country now. Democrats, if they're worth their salt, will come up with somebody better no matter how many folks end up throwing their hat in the ring. And I would say the more, the merrier. I think as far as progressives are concerned, and I consider myself to be, if I have to put a label on myself, a progressive. As far as progressives are concerned, we have some pretty good people who want to be the Democratic nominee for president. Some good people. I don't have to name them. You know who they are, including a couple of dark horse candidates that are like way off to one side and who might just end up being the nominee. One of the things that I'm glad to see this time around is that it doesn't appear, at least in the early going, that the Democratic National Committee has put their thumb on the scale in favor of any particular candidate. And we saw what happened the last time they did that. Enough said. It is open. It needs to be open. And people need to have the ability to put forward their ideas, their issues, and voters to pay attention and figure out who best speaks to your issues. You know, I'm a small D Democrat. Small D, not big D. I may vote big D, but I'm not, in my heart of hearts, a big D Democrat as much as I am a small D Democrat. And the difference is, of course, a small D Democrat, theoretically, is a promoter and an adherent to democracy, to popular rule. And I hope that the Democratic Party, this time around, will do a better job than they did the last time around. The polls are going to come out. And, you know, the late Mickey Carroll, who used to run the Q poll, I used to have on the air with me all the time. Mickey was a very, very knowledgeable guy. But polling sometimes can be wrong. And I could spend the next 20 minutes talking about polls that were so wrong, it was almost laughable. Now, we're in a position where polling drives fundraising. So that polling, it's a lot more high stakes than it used to be. At one time, a poll was a poll was a poll. Now, if you're down in the polls, you can't raise money. And if you can't raise money, you can't get your message across. And all of that is part of what needs to change about the American electoral process. I mean, the Electoral College is a whole separate issue. But we need to be able to hear from everybody on a relatively equal basis. And the kind of fundraising that people have to do to run for a party's nomination for president is daunting. It is absolutely daunting. And as far as I'm concerned, there's no excuse for it. Everybody should be able to open their mouth. I mean, everybody who seriously wants to become president of the United States. I'm not just talking about people in a bar someplace. Everybody who wants to be president should be able to articulate their vision to the American people. And it becomes incumbent on the American people then to sit back and say, what are my issues? What am I concerned about? What are these people saying to my issues? There's nothing wrong with voters having issues that they find important. And far more important, in my humble judgment, than the horse race element, the and they're off element of political elections, is the formation of ideas and visions in the electorate about what suits you best. Is it single-payer healthcare? Maybe. Is it a better electoral process? Maybe. Is it low-cost college so more and more people can get educated? Maybe. There are so many. Is it the environment? Maybe. And by the way, when I say maybe, that's not to say that any of these should not be, because I think they all should be, personally. But when I look to vote for a particular candidate, these are the things that I look at. And then I look at each candidate's position on those issues. And I take away massive points if they don't have one. Because, you know, some people decide to run for office and they got no position on nothing, or at least not a firm position on much. And I tend to look not so much at metrics, but I tend to look at the kinds of things that are measurable in the body politic and ask, if you want to be president of the United States, what are you going to do to make this measure better? I mentioned this, I think, in an earlier episode. If 55% of our kids read at or above grade level, it's not too much to ask a candidate for president, what are you going to do to make it 75 or 90 or 95 when it comes to voting? If 50% of Americans vote, what are you going to do to open up the process so that more people vote? 75%, 80%, 90% of the eligible electorate turn out to vote. You know, it's really, to me, a sad thing that there are a lot of people who could benefit from enlightened leadership at the top who don't bother. They just sit back and say, ah, man, not good enough anymore. Not good enough anymore. And it may be a little early to ask voters, or in this case, listeners to this podcast, to think about, like, who should be the next president of the United States. It's early yet, but it's entirely possible that with some work. And see, to me, politics is work. If you want to be enlightened and make enlightened choices for elected office, it's not like you simply sit back and look, or even look at the latest, you know, the evening news or whatever. They have to do a little digging. Maybe if more people had done some digging, we wouldn't have the president we have now. If more people had read Wayne Barrett's book, and Wayne, rest in peace, a brilliant man and one of the finest reporters New York City has ever produced, you could say maybe people would look at it differently. But that's up to the electorate. And if you believe in the popular will, if you believe in the popular vote, even when it goes against your beliefs, even when it's a situation where things that you might not want to see are voted on and passed, then fine. Fight against them. Get up and fight. I mean, not physically, obviously, but get up and fight for what you believe in. If you think you're right, why not make it right? And right now we're looking at a situation in this country where there's a lot wrong. It's not just about a border wall. It's not. It's about watching the food stamp program die during the time this government shut down. How are you going to do that so it never happens again? How are you going to make sure that this government never takes food out of the mouths of children again? Because right now they are. And there's no excuse for it. Why don't we try to hold our politicians and our aspiring politicians accountable for the positions that they take? And by the way, one of the people I didn't mention who is, if not thinking about running for president, certainly wants to be a progressive kingmaker in the race for president is New York City's Mayor Bill de Blasio, who, by the way, gets pilloried a lot and deserves to get pilloried a lot over certain issues, but he doesn't always get credit for the issues that he has worked on and succeeded at. But that's another discussion. We are in a situation now, in 2019, where we cannot afford to get it wrong. Or dare I say it, not afford to get it wrong again. How about that? We cannot stand here, or sit here for that matter, and watch this country implode. That's right, implode. Sooner or later, there's going to be another recession. There's going to be another situation where people are going to be struggling. Massive amounts of people are going to get laid off. 401ks taking huge hits. All of this is going to happen. It's our economic cycle. Now, if we want to change our system, our economic system, that's different. I don't know that there's some huge consensus for doing that. Maybe there should be. But there is this sort of feast and famine that has gone on in America since the country was founded. And to me, we have to be prepared for the lean times, for the times when things are not all going well. And I got to be honest with you, I'm not sure this administration, the one we have, is at all prepared to watch that happen, at all prepared to respond to it. And believe me, if, you know, this is like a hey, duh kind of situation, we will be in deep, deep economic trouble. And deep economic trouble sometimes produces results that people are not at all happy with. Now, in a future episode, I'll talk about one of the things that makes me very nervous about 2020. And it's not about who the Democrats pick. It's about what happens if the Democrats win. When we come back, I'm going to start a series, and I'm going to do this periodically. And I'm going to talk about words and phrases that need to die. And I'm not talking about, you know, a physical death. But there are words and phrases that have become popular in the 21st century that don't need to be popular in the 21st century. They need to go someplace and die. And we're going to talk about two of them when we come back. This is The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley. I'd love to hear from you on my Facebook page, Mark Riley Media. Or email me, mark@markrileymedia.com. Back in a flash. Welcome back to the home stretch of The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley. Thank you so much for listening to my podcast. And as mentioned before the break, this is something I will proudly present from time to time. something I'm going to be doing on a recurring basis. Words and phrases that need to go someplace and die. So we're going to take up the first two. Number one, thought leader. What the hell is a thought leader? Is it somebody who tells other people what to think? Because to me, that would be a thought leader. Somebody, you know, gets people to sit in a circle and they start spouting their belief system or what they think is important, and everybody else just sits there nodding, and therefore that person that comes up with these ideas, no matter how half-cocked they are, that makes that person a thought leader. Is there a college degree that I missed where somebody can major in thought leadership? The very term thought leader implies that people can't think for themselves. I am unalterably opposed to anything that implies that humankind cannot think and make decisions for themselves. I was, as a young man, constantly criticized, reprimanded, had my mother go upside my head for questioning things. If my mother was the thought leader, I wanted to know why. I wanted to know why about everything. I was extremely, extremely lucky as a young man to have attended an educational institution that encouraged questioning as a form and a pathway to critical thinking. Something that I get a sense is kind of sort of lacking in 21st century America. Now, that's not to say that I think people are stupid or that people are uneducated or that people are ignorant. See, because that, to me, is the worst possible thing you can do or say to somebody. You ignorant, man. No. But I think that the whole concept of a thought leader implies that there are large numbers of people who are ignorant, who don't know any better and have to be told. Why else would there be any need for a thought leader? And it's funny because I keep thinking in my head as I'm saying this about a commercial where somebody says something about the world. What was it? Something thought about from the world's leading thought leaders. And I'm thinking, who are they? Is there a certain part of America that they all inhabit? Do they sit around and talk among themselves about what thoughts they think other people ought to have? I just find the whole concept of thought leader to be just a wee bit patronizing, a wee bit condescending, and something that ought to go someplace and die. Now, if there are, I don't want to insult people who believe themselves to be thought leaders, but a thought leader doesn't mean a doggone thing unless they are able, and I still don't like the term, but unless they are able to encourage other people to think and form their own opinions about things, independent of the alleged thought leader. Why should the thought leader have a monopoly on smart thinking? It just gets my goat, to use an old term. And it's one of those things that seems to have come along in the 21st century. I never heard of a thought leader before 2000, 2002 or so. Maybe thought leaders were around before that. I don't know. Was Einstein a thought leader? Were other brilliant people? Was Dwight D. Eisenhower, who led the European theater during World War II, was he a thought leader? Because they didn't refer to themselves that way. And I'm not sure anyone else referred to them that way. But, when I see, and I have, on people's resumes, graduated from this place, did this, and I'm a thought leader. If I was an employer, I would question that very, very hard. Now, I'm not an employer. If people want to call themselves thought leaders, God love them. I just think it's a phrase that is empty of meaning in contemporary America and just doesn't need to be repeated over and over and over again. And if it's so now embedded in the American psyche, thought leadership, then they ought to make a college course or a major or a minor or something in thought leadership. So that way, at least we know exactly what it is. Because I'll be honest, I don't know what it is. I don't know what it means. I've talked to an awful lot of people. I had a radio career that was quite long. A lot of that was taken up talking to people on the telephone. I don't consider myself, by encouraging people to think critically or by questioning their beliefs or reinforcing their beliefs in certain cases, I don't consider myself a thought leader. That's absurd. If I can help people think critically about issues that confront them, so much the better, so good. But I'm not a thought leader. Again, maybe it's me. I think it's insulting to call somebody a thought leader. I think people who consider themselves thought leaders are somehow looking down on the rest of us. In other words, we can't think unless they tell us. We can't come to our own conclusions unless we validate those conclusions. I think that's nonsense. I think that is complete and utter nonsense. But that's just me. Maybe people believe that thought leaders are the greatest thing since sliced bread. Maybe they are. I just don't think so. So that's one phrase that needs to go someplace, find someplace to die. I'm hoping 5-10 years, my grandkids are older, they won't be using the term thought leaders. And by the way, while we're at it, there's one other one. This is like a 1 and a 1A. For some reason, and maybe it's me, when I hear people start a sentence with the word so, it just drives me crazy. So, you don't have to say so. You can just say I or we or however you want to start the sentence. So is not necessary. Or maybe it is. You know, I could be wrong. Maybe people think that it is necessary to start a sentence with so. I don't hear it as much as I used to, so maybe it's starting to get off the dime just a wee bit, but that's my 1A, so. And I know I said I was only going to do 2, but hey, I lied. I'm going to do 3. So is a word that certainly should be used under certain circumstances. I'm not saying so needs to die. Just beginning every sentence with the word so. And I've seen people, when questioned, lead 2 or 3 sentences with the word so. Like it's a way to organize their thoughts. And maybe it is. There's no law. There's nothing wrong with it. I just find it, I don't know, a wee bit lazy, perhaps. The other phrase that needs to go is the term influencer. I had a discussion with somebody who actually believes in the term influencers recently. I had heard the term influencer relatively recently, and I really kind of had to get a definition of what people mean by it. And this particular person said, well, so-and-so's an influencer because he's got 2 million followers on whatever, Instagram, whatever social media this person chooses to use. And I'm saying to myself, well, all that means is that he has been adept at getting people to follow him. Does that mean he's worth following because people follow him? Yeah, but if you get him to say this or that, well, why should I have to get somebody to follow something or get somebody to say something that would cause people to think, you know what, that's an influencer? No, I think that is pretty much absurd as well. Now, I had influencers as a kid, right? As a kid and as a young man. But these were influencers that actually made a difference in my life, okay? Let me tell you a few of them. Harry Belafonte, Muhammad Ali, Jim Brown, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Bill Russell, Tommy Smith, John Carlos. Those were influencers. Why? Because they were prepared to put their careers on the line to stand up for young black men like me at that time. That was an influencer. Why? Because it encouraged me to follow their example. It encouraged me to think not just of myself, but of the people that were coming up behind me, which is what they did. That's an influencer. But I don't know, maybe Jim Brown does count the number of followers he has and calls himself an influencer. For some reason, I don't think so. I just don't think so. I don't think any of these individuals. Ali, of course, has passed. God rest his soul. By the way, Tommy Smith, John Carlos, still out here doing the work. A half century after they stunned the world and put up a clenched fist at the Olympics in Mexico City. That's an influencer. Muhammad Ali telling people, I'm pretty. As a black man, to hear someone say, I'm pretty, that was like hitting me over the head with a brick. Because black people in the early 60s were not encouraged to call themselves pretty or beautiful or smart. Prettier, more beautiful, and smarter than non-black people. That was not something that we were encouraged to think. Even our parents, they would tell us we have to be twice as good, but they never, my mother never told me, hey, yeah, go ahead, call yourself pretty. Muhammad Ali called himself pretty, and that influenced me not to call myself pretty, but to think of myself differently because he had guts. And I think that to an extent, if you want to talk about influencers, and I don't know why anybody would necessarily have to, but if you want to talk about influencers, talk about people that have stood up and made a difference that you were able to see and feel, that you, in an ideal world, were able to emulate. That's what's important to me about being an influencer, being somebody that you can jump up and say, you know what? Jim Brown did it. I can do it. Muhammad Ali said it, I can say it. Those are influencers. And they're not just prominent people. One influencer, One person who influenced me deeply is a gentleman that most of you will never know. He passed away a couple of years ago, and his name was David Mancuso. He was the host of a place called The Loft, which was and is a magical place. And I mean a magical place. But David influenced me to think differently about both music, which I loved even before I met him, but made me think differently about music, my approach to music, what was good. But he also heavily influenced my concept of sound, not just musical sound, sound. And there is in that an influence for me that has lasted me the 35, 40 years since I first met this man. And again, he's no longer with us, but anyone who is listening to this and has ever been to The Loft, you know what I'm talking about. Because David literally influenced hundreds of thousands of people and had no interest whatsoever, A, in being called an influencer, and B, anyone particularly knowing who he was. That's how humble this man was. Influencers needs to go someplace and die. I mean, not to, you know, stomp on its neck or anything, but we need to find some different means and methodologies for acknowledging those who make a difference in our lives. And if we have to call, you know, when I was young, the term influence was most often connected with influence peddling, okay? And that was illegal. People used to get locked up for it. So at this point, if an influencer is so important, let them be humble in spreading their influence. Let them be the kind of people that folk look up to and say, you know what? They stood up. I'm going to stand up. I thank you so much for listening to this podcast. My executive producer is Ms. Kim Jack Riley. If you want to like my Facebook page, you can do so at Mark Riley Media. You can send me an email at mark@markrileymedia.com. If you have a topic that you'd like me to cover, email me, mark@markrileymedia.com. What are you thinking about the 2020 elections? Please hit me up, mark@markreillymedia.com. Till we meet again, be safe.